Hearty greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in this week for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
Well, let's kick off today's show on this 31st day of July with a baseball milestone featuring the number 31. On Sunday, Adrian Beltre, the third baseman for Major League Baseball's Texas Rangers, earned his 3,000th career hit, a double off of Baltimore Orioles pitcher Wade Miley. Now, by reaching that mark, Beltre becomes the 31st player in Major League Baseball history to reach that mark, 31st player in the last 120 years. And he becomes just the fifth player born outside the U.S., and the first ever player from the Dominican Republic to join the 3,000 hit club. Fitting with this major milestone, the celebrations didn't wait until the end of the game. They began right after Beltre's hit. As the two teams and thousands of fans looked on, Beltre's three children took to the field to unfurl a banner in honor of their father before joining him at second base for a family embrace. Beltre is in his 20th season in Major League Baseball, having played for the Los Angeles Dodgers, Seattle Mariners, Boston Red Sox, and the Texas Rangers, his current team. Baseball experts often say that getting to 3,000 hits is one of the biggest milestones of the game and all but assures a place at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. That sentiment was perhaps best summed up in a tweet from Fox Sports congratulating Beltre. It read simply, "Adrian Beltre, welcome to baseball immortality." So a big Sunny Side of Sports shout out and congratulations to Adrian Beltre, the newest member of Major League Baseball's 3,000 hit club. Well, from the legends of baseball, we move now to a legend of tennis. Donald Dell began his career as a tennis player in the 1960s, reaching the quarterfinals of the 1961 U.S. Open. After he retired from playing, Dell partnered with former players Jack Kramer and Cliff Drysdale and sports manager Bob Briner to form the Association of Tennis Professionals in 1972, the organization that today governs men's professional tennis. Now, that would already make Don Dell a tennis legend, but that's not all he's done for the sport. He's the founder of sports management agency ProServe Incorporated, and through ProServe, he would go on to manage some of the greats of the game, including Yvon Lendl, Jimmy Connors, and his close friend Arthur Ashe. He served as a tennis television commentator, captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team, and as vice chairman of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, which he was inducted into in 2009. I had the distinct honor of speaking with Donald Dell last week about his life, his contributions to tennis, and the future of the sport. And since he's played a major role in tennis history since the 1960s, I started our conversation by asking him, how has the game changed over the past five decades?
Well, it's a tough question. I think it's gotten much, much better for the players across the board. I mean, the prize money has grown. Television exposure has been fabulous. Sponsorship is up. So from a player point of view, they ought to go to bed at night and say, God bless mommy, daddy, and the ATP tour. On the downside is that in a partnership, it's not really effectively a 50-50 deal because you got three players, you got three tournaments. And the tournaments who are elected, you elect one from the Americas, one from Europe, and then one from, quote, the rest of the world. So they're geographically elected, but all of them that are there are tournament directors. So they're a little bit intimidated by the players. And so, in my opinion, the players have a distinct edge in running the tour as a tour board. And I think as a result of that, everybody has sort of catered to the players. It's exploded been great for the players. I don't think it's always been, you know, great for the tournaments. And I think one of the downsides of the tour board is that, you know, a player can enter. Players enter 6 weeks before the tournament. There are all kinds of rules for entry, but they can also withdraw at the last minute. And if there's not, you know, with a medical excuse, which any player can get at any time for any reason, and if somebody is legitimately hurt, no problem, he shouldn't play. But a lot of times, players will enter, and then, like last year, for example, in Washington, we lost four players on the day of the draw, and they were all good players. And then the next week, Toronto lost seven players on the day of the draw. Well, there's got to be a tightening up of the rules. And the ATP Tour Board knows that a lot of the tournaments feel this way. You just asked me what was the downside. I think that's one of the serious weaknesses. How do you get a legitimate rule that if a player's hurt, no problem. But he can't just suddenly decide, well, his wife doesn't feel like going to that city this week, or he didn't. It's too hot, or the weather's not good. So, I played well last week, so I'll pull out next week. That doesn't augur well for the tournaments, and you don't have a business if you can't be sure of who your talents are. I mean, they're the talent; they're the ones you're selling, and so that's one of the weaknesses of the system. But I know the ATP Tour Board, as a group, is trying very hard now to find what's a happy medium to balance that. And if they succeed in that, it'll strengthen the tour, in my opinion.
Looking more broadly at the sport, we've seen a lot of changes in how it's played. We've seen changes off the court in terms of sports management, in terms of media. And I know that you're connected to both of those areas. You were one of the big sports managers back, managing people like Ivan Lendl, Jimmy Connors, Arthur Ashe. Talk a bit about that. Could you tell from that time when you started managing them that they were going to be these stars of the game? What was it like to interact with them?
Well, no, I think they were the stars of the game, and I wasn't surprised by that, you know, at all. I mean, I thought they were, and were going to be bigger and bigger, and they have been, and they've grown the sport. I was always in favor of that. My goal was, when I started in 1970, I was the Davis Cup captain in 68 and 69. I resigned and started my business in 1970. And my goal was very simple, to try and make a tennis player a professional the way a golfer was. When someone said, what do you do for a living? And the guy said, I'm a professional tennis player. Before 1968, you had players, and I was one of them. I played until 66, and I retired and went to law school. And I said, you know, I wasn't the best player. There was no money in the sport. People said, what do you do? And basically, so I play tennis full-time. Well, how do you play tennis full-time if there's no money in the sport? And the answer was, you're getting under-the-table excessive expenses. And that all changed in 1968 and 69 when the game went open. So I was very much in favor of promoting and building the sport, and I think a lot of the agents, I ran a company called ProServe, and Mark McCormick ran a company called IMG, and there's a third company now called Octagon. And we promoted the sport of tennis and the events and tournaments and television sponsorship, you know, professionally all over the world. And we very quickly outgrew many of the national federations who wanted to control everything but didn't do anything to build the sport. And so the players are the stars and are the talent, and I'm very much in their corner. But I think there's a responsibility that sometimes is lost because they're so dominant. The other thing that's interesting, if you thought about it a moment, is everything in the games of tennis has changed. I mean, we played, it was wood rackets. It was on grass courts. Most of American tournaments, the majors, were on a grass court circuit leading into the U.S. Open all 7 weeks in the summer. The Davis Cup was huge and global. The scoring system, there was no tiebreaker. Today, all that's changed. They're using high-tech rackets with all kinds of different materials, making up better rackets. The balls bounce much higher. The two-handed backhand, people come under it and topspin. We didn't have one. There's one tennis player in all of the 60s that used the two-handed backhand. Only one, and that was Cliff Drysdale. And there was a young 16-year-old coming along named Chrissy Evert who used it for the women, and she was very successful, and everybody copied her. And the women loved the two-handed backhand because it gave them strength on that side. So, I mean, everything in tennis, in a lot of ways, has changed since 1968 and 69 to today's modern game. And it's a much better game, and it's a much bigger game, and it's a much more healthy game. I just want the players to accept a bigger responsibility for their share of the success. They're very much involved in this success, but they also need to have a greater responsibility in certain areas. That's my only point.
And one of the big ways that tennis has changed in the past 45, 50 years in the open era is media. You started out as a broadcaster in the 1970s. Today we have a whole channel devoted to tennis on television.
Sure.
And there's, in addition to that, social media, there's digital media, web. You can stream these matches online. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? And how has that changed the game, especially because tennis is such a mental game? Does that impact the players?
Well, I think it's a great thing for the players. I mean, tennis, here's the story on tennis in one sentence. Outside of North America, tennis anywhere in the world is one, two, or three in ranking. In most places, soccer is one. And in many places, basketball may be two. But tennis is always three or two, depending on the country. You know, if you're in Australia, it's two after soccer or rugby. I mean, it's always in the top three. In America, tennis is probably 9, 10, or 11 among the sports. And that's a real problem because, you know, your best athletes, your young athletes, they all want to be on television. That's a big problem, you know, as to what they're doing. And so as a result, I think that the sport has grown tremendously because of television. The more television, the better. Now that the social media is coming in, I think some of the Netflix and Amazon and others, they're going to try to get into tennis. I mean, Amazon just bought the NFL rights to Thursday Night Football along with CBS. It's going to get bigger and bigger. Let's cut to the chase. Television is what makes the world go round. Plain and simple, that's all. You know, just it does. And anybody that tells you differently it doesn't understand the sports world, in my opinion.
It's a big moneymaker for sure, and it has gotten a lot more players exposure. And that's something I want to ask you about. If you were back managing these great players, Yvon Lendl, Jimmy Connors, Arthur Ashe, how would you counsel them on media exposure? What advice would you give them on dealing with this media?
Well, you'd
climate?
Like to try and coach them and try to. I mean, some of them were very, very good at it. Ash was great at it. Connors could be. He'd be on and off. He could be as articulate and positive as. I mean, he was. Jimmy Connors sold more tickets in America for 10 years than anybody. And then you go to Lendl, and Lendl sort of had a. Lendl was a great player, but he sort of had a chip on his shoulder. I remember, this is a true story, we were running the Masters Final in Madison Square Garden for the Volvo Championships years ago, and I walked into a press conference, and they had asked Lendl a few questions, and he was sort of in a grumpy mood and serious and everything. The press conference ended. So I walk into the press conference, it ends, and I go up to Lendl, and I said, Yvon, listen, I will personally... and our company, ProServe, who is managing him, we will guarantee you $1 million more next year in marketing if you will just smile during these press conferences. You don't have to answer even. You know, just smile. And he looked at me, and he thought for about 4 seconds, and here was his answer. He said, nope, I won't do it. It's not worth it. That was Yvon Lendl. You know, that's a true story. Today, he's coaching Murray, and he's a lot different. You know, he's pleasant to the press, and he was promoting an event in New York, Madison Square Garden, with Jerry Solomon. He was one of the promoters. He owned the. He was all smiles to all sponsors, and I was teasing. I'd come in there, I said, Yvon, you're smiling. You're only 30 years late. But I mean, you know, people learn. I mean, it's just, you know, how you act on the court, your body language is important. I used to say Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith were good players who were great people. And I meant that. They were great people. A lot of the great champions, you don't have to be a jerk to be a champion. The people that say, and I won't name names, but so-and-so, well, he's a great player, he contests so much, he represents the country, he tries so hard, and he can be a jerk is nonsense. I mean, Jack Kramer wasn't a jerk. Rod Laver, John Newcomb, Federer, Nadal, these are not jerks. They're great players. So I don't buy the argument that you have to be a jerk to be a good player. That's a cop-out completely. Many of the great players, you know, are great people, and certainly Federer and Nadal are two of them. I can tell you that. I mean, what's changed in the game today, and it's partly because of the money, you know, the four semifinalists at Wimbledon this year were all over 31 years of age. It's interesting. Everyone's playing longer. Why? Because it's a career. So, to me, the money has gotten so big, so fat, for men and women, that the players are trying to stay in shape and play longer. But one of the biggest changes from our sport is the physicality of these players. They are in phenomenal shape. When we played in the 60s, if it rained and the matches were canceled, we either go play hearts or poker or go to a movie or dinner, you know, as a group. Today, they all go to the gym for 2 hours and work out. And that's a tribute to them. I mean, the athletes today, I mean, are phenomenally. Look at Murray. I don't think Murray is necessarily the best talent, but he sure as hell is in the best shape of anybody when he became number one last year. And when we played a guy named Roy Emerson of Australia, everybody feared playing Emerson because they knew in the fifth set he wasn't going to get tired. He was in great shape, as was Laver, but Laver was a pro at times and couldn't play in these events in the 60s. I mean, he won the Grand Slam in 62, turned pro. They wouldn't let him play. The game went open in 68. He came back in 69. Guess what? Laver won the Grand Slam again. No one's ever done that. He probably would have won the Grand Slam four or five times if he had been left to play between 62 and 69. Those are valuable years that he lost because the game wasn't open.
Tomorrow, we'll have part two of my interview with Donald Dell, where we'll talk about the growth of tennis around the world and two sisters who Dell says have changed the face of tennis forever. And I bet you can't guess who those are. You have to tune in tomorrow to find out. I'm Andrew Belcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
This is The Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
Voice of America.
Suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dyke, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hi, I'm Susan Yawkey of VOA's International Edition. VOA's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of some of the world's greatest experts on international issues. But you don't have to tune in at broadcast time. Listen when you want. Just go to voanews.com. Click the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition.
Hi, this is Lori London. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondence reports around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
The Voice of America.
And some developing news now. Kenyan middle distance runner David Rudisha, the two-time Olympic gold medalist and the world record holder in the 800 meter, has withdrawn from the World Athletics Championship in London, set to begin this Friday. Rudisha tweeting out a photo of his leg wrapped up in black, red, and green elastic muscle tape with the following message to his over 215,000 Twitter followers. Quote, "It's sad and disappointing to announce my no-show in the forthcoming hashtag London2017WC due to a quad muscle strain. This announcement is being met with surprise and disappointment from fans online, many of whom are looking forward to seeing Rudisha run next week. Mixed in with those responses are well wishes for Rudisha's recovery and hopes that he'll be able to return to the track soon. Among the messages pouring in, you will be missed, especially because it's your Olympic track. Wishing you a speedy recovery, champ." That coming from Ed Harry. Others saying, "Wishing you a full and speedy recovery. Get well soon, and we will miss you." But once again, David Rudisha, the Kenyan middle distance runner and 800 meter world record holder, out of the World Athletics Championship in London. And the brief programming note, before he left for vacation, Sonny spoke with track analyst Parker Pick Up the Pace Morse about what to expect from the World Athletics Championship, and we'll have that report for you later in the week. And finally, it's not uncommon to find a high level of drama in sports, but usually that drama is contained to the playing field. That wasn't the case, though, with two stories that are trending today. First, we go to the U.S. state of Wisconsin, where Major League Baseball's Milwaukee Brewers took on the defending World Series champion Chicago Cubs on Sunday. And in attendance at that game was Chris Christie, governor of the U.S. state of New Jersey and an ally of President Donald Trump. Well, during that game, a fan reportedly confronted Christie about his political views, prompting Christie to get in a verbal altercation with that fan and sarcastically calling him a big shot. Video of that altercation taken by a fan sitting nearby has spread across social media, some saying Christie overreacted, others saying, though, that the fan should have been more respectful. And then others are noting that the huge plate of nachos that Chris Christie was holding during the incident, inspiring a lot of people to cook some nachos of their own, maybe. That story, though, at least took place in a sports arena. The same can't be said for an incident involving some of the National Basketball Association's biggest stars. This weekend, forward Harrison Barnes of the Dallas Mavericks got married. And as a brief aside, we congratulate him and his new wife. At that wedding, there were a number of Barnes NBA colleagues, including Golden State Warriors star Steph Curry. Now here's where the drama begins. In a viral video posted to Instagram, Curry seems to mock his rival LeBron James, mimicking some of the moves that James made in a recent workout video that he posted to social media. Now that right there would make a dramatic story, but the plot thickens when the video pans around, and who do we see laughing at Curry's mockery? None other than Kyrie Irving, LeBron's teammate on the Cleveland Cavaliers. Last week, we talked about the drama between Kyrie and LeBron after Irving asked to be traded out of Cleveland, and LeBron James reportedly said he wanted to beat him up, a claim that James denied on social media. This video just adds another element to that story, one that fans were quick to pick up on and react to. Some say it's akin to Kyrie Irving stabbing LeBron James in the back before he leaves town. Others say it's a petty move by Kyrie Irving. But whatever your opinion, I think it's safe to say that this won't be the last back and forth between these players. And that wraps up things on this July 31st edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Dan Crafton, and thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and that's The Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Swaziland has a problem. It has the world's highest prevalence of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. According to UNAIDS, in 2016, 220,000 people out of a population of about 1.5 million were living with HIV, including 27.2% of all adults ages 15 to 49. Last year, 3,900 citizens of Swaziland died as a result of the HIV virus, and 8,800 were newly infected. In 2016, life expectancy for men was 52 years, 51 years for women. 10 years ago, the government of Swaziland made a commitment to stabilizing the epidemic with an eye to eventually reversing it. With the support of the U.S. government, through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the Ministry of Health and other partners expanded access to comprehensive HIV prevention, care, and treatment services for all persons living with HIV/AIDS. The effort has proven to be a success. On July 24th, PEPFAR issued groundbreaking data showing that the HIV epidemic is coming under control across all age groups in Swaziland. Additional PEPFAR-supported studies released in December 2016 show similar results in Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The rate of new HIV infections in these countries has decreased by more than 50%, and in Swaziland by nearly half. Malawi, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe are among the 13 highest burden countries where PEPFAR is accelerating its efforts toward reaching epidemic control by 2020 through the UNAIDS 90-90-90 framework and expansion of HIV prevention, while simultaneously sustaining support to all countries and populations where it works. We now have clear evidence that four African countries are approaching control of their HIV epidemics, said U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy, Ambassador Deborah Birx, M.D. These unprecedented findings demonstrate the remarkable impact of the U.S. government's efforts through PEPFAR and the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria in partnership with African countries. We now have a historic opportunity to change the very course of the HIV pandemic.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll preview the August 8th Kenyan presidential race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and former Kenyan Prime Minister Raila Odinga. The latest public opinion polls say the ballot is too close to call. That's on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.